Welcome to Intention to Treat from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Rachel Gottbaum. Today, we talk about Parkinson's disease. It's the fastest growing neurologic condition in the world, and some 90,000 people are diagnosed with Parkinson's each year in the U.S. What do we know about this disease, and are we getting closer to finding ways to actually stop its progression?
My name is Denise Coley. I am 72 years old. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2018.
My name is Larry Gifford, and I was diagnosed with young onset Parkinson's disease at the age of 45. That was 7 years ago. I was collecting symptoms for about 10 years because as a guy, I didn't like to go to the doctor.
When I was in my 50s, I noticed that several things happened. I was a little bit tired, but I had a job that started at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and ended around 6 or 7 at night. So I just put it to that. But besides that, I had stiffness. My right arm wasn't swinging. I had small handwriting. So it would be extremely small and it would get smaller until you couldn't really read it. I also had constipation.
But it started with my gait, my walk. It was kind of wonky. And then it started to affect my ability to take notes in meetings. I couldn't use my right hand to do typing. It was just a collection of weird symptoms.
I couldn't figure out what's going on.
And then the tremor came. And my son goes, "Dad, why are you spilling the water everywhere?" I said, "I don't know." He goes, "You should go see a doctor." He was 5.
My children at Thanksgiving 2017 said, "You're shaking." I'm looking like, "Me? Shaking? No, I'm not shaking." I didn't realize I was. And we called the doctor who referred us to a neurologist, and he declared I had Parkinson's.
I'd never been on any medication in my life. I'd never had any chronic illness. I felt like I was on top of the world. And then they thought, well, maybe it's MS. So they sent me to the MS specialist, and the MS specialist said, "Good news, you don't have MS, but I think you have Parkinson's."
I truly believed it was a death sentence.
It was gobsmacking to me. I'm sure he told us not to look it up on the internet, but we did immediately. And then he just gets more scared.
And I was thinking, well, will I immediately be going into a wheelchair? Will I not be walking?
I really was rejecting the whole premise of Parkinson's. I wanted it to be a cancer rather than that, because at least they could pull that out of me. I was angry. I was looking for answers at the bottom of whiskey bottles. Apparently, they're not there.
I don't want to be looked at as incapable. I don't want to be looked at as somebody that was different than originally was.
The framing for me in regards to Parkinson's was, it's a slow moving disease. You'll notice some things, but it's not going to get really bad for you, Larry, for a long time. 3-4 years later, I was losing my voice somewhat, and I was really having troubles with my executive functioning.
A lot of people will walk around with their hands in their pockets, and that might be to shake off the tremor so people can't see it. I went to a pharmacy to pick up my meds. The lady looked at me and she says, "There's no drinking with the medication you're getting." I said, "I don't drink." And she repeated it 3 times because I was shaking.
My neurologist, he's like, "Listen, you don't need deep brain stimulation, DBS, right now. But let's get you on the list." I think we waited about 4 years. By the time it came up, I was ready. I was stutter stepping. I was hunched over. I could barely talk. I could barely walk. I needed support for my wife to even get in the car. I mean, she was like, holy crap, you aged like 30 years.
So with my doctor, we discussed what line of action we should take. So what we did is a slow regimen. Eventually, I was put on to Retari. And when I took the Retari, I felt like an Energizer Bunny, which was a good thing and a bad thing, because Energizer Bunny means I can do more and stay up more hours and multi-focus rather than single focus. So I had to really pull back and really adjust to the new feelings and what to do. But it has worked out really well for me.
I had the deep brain stimulation surgery in late October, and it's been quite a remarkable process. I have slowly gone off most of my medication, and I think better, I move better. So what they've done is they've inserted basically a battery in my chest that sends electric current into the electrodes that are implanted in my brain near where the Parkinson's issues are happening. And I have control, and I can pump up or down the electric current. If I'm finding I can't walk very well for a moment or whatever, I'll kick it in. And it's immediate. It's totally like, it's like right now, boom, done.
Parkinson's has a stigma. You're not one of the club if you don't keep up. You're not one of the club if you're falling. You're not one of the club if you're getting slow. There's still a lot of life to people. There's still a lot that they can give, but we need much more awareness. If we truly had an accepting work environment, then people could continue to live and prosper and do well in their job with Parkinson's. The person you see is the same person. They just have a disease, and some days they'll have good days, some days they might have bad days. But they are the same loving person that you knew from the beginning. And the funny thing is, when you talk to somebody, more often than not, they have somebody they know who has Parkinson's.
Parkinson's itself is kind of growing out of control at this point. It's currently the fastest growing neurological condition in the world. And it is responsible for the most disability hours. And so we need to educate people on what it means to have Parkinson's. It doesn't mean that I'm useless. It doesn't mean that I can't do jobs. Just because it's a brain disease doesn't mean it's tearing apart the information and knowledge I have. That remains. I will always have that innate knowledge. I suspect I've got a good 10 years left in me before it starts to really go downhill. But I don't know. You know, none of us do. That's the crime of Parkinson's, is it's the gift that keeps on taking. So I'm going to go about my life and love my family and find ways to make a difference in the world. And maybe I will, maybe I won't, but at least I'll be giving it the old college try.
Since my diagnosis, I have learned the beauty of quality of life. It means something different maybe each day, but still focus on quality of life. So my goal as a Parkinson advocate is that everyone can have hope and everyone can thrive and have quality of life. I often think of Maya Angelou. She said, hope and fear cannot exist together. You must choose one. I choose hope.
This is Intention to Treat from the New England Journal of Medicine. We're now joined by Dr. David Standert. He's chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Alabama School of Medicine. Dr. Standert, tell us a bit about the evolution of our understanding of Parkinson's disease.
James Parkinson, who was a physician in England, gave this disease its name. He published a book in 1817 called An Essay on the Shaking Palsy. And he described seven patients, only two or three of which he actually examined in the office. The others he saw sitting on a park bench in London. But he described many of the features of what we call Parkinson's disease now, the tremor, the slowness, the bent posture. He also talks about some of the things we've only really come to emphasize recently, like sleep disorders, constipation. All of this is in Parkinson's original book. So this is 1817. I think the next real milestones came probably in the early 1900s, realizing that this degenerative disease of the brain led to these symptoms. Another big leap forward was figuring out what the chemical was that was most critical here, and that's dopamine. And levodopa happened in the early 1960s. And by 1969, the famous paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine described how you could take levodopa and if you could get a patient onto a stable dose, and it would have a dramatic effect on the symptoms.
But levodopa, which is still very much the gold standard, has its limitations.
I think we were pretty good at initial treatment of Parkinson's. Most people who came in with early symptoms, we could do pretty well treating them. But we were seeing a lot of the problems that come up later in the game. After a number of years on levodopa, you get wearing off. You often get dyskinesia, these violent, uncontrollable, involuntary movements.
So before levodopa, I understand surgeons tried to treat Parkinson's by burning a hole in the brain, and that later this kind of approach led to deep brain stimulation, which we use today.
So, you know, the discovery of making a lesion in the brain and treating Parkinson's was accidental. It was an observation made by a neurosurgeon during an operation for a vascular disease, and he tied off a blood vessel, and that person's Parkinson's got better. By 1992, we thought we understood why certain structures were overactive in Parkinson's and why lesioning them could improve the symptoms. And so we did lesions. Some of my patients had lesions done. It was okay for a while, but ultimately not that easy to control. We also learned that lesioning both sides of the brain produced a lot of problems. People lost their ability to speak. And this is when deep brain stimulation started to really emerge on the scene. So developing a technique to put a wire in the brain, stimulate or activate or inhibit certain structures with this electrical current. And that became a treatment for Parkinson's that is widely used today.
Do we understand how deep brain stimulation works?
Not entirely, no. There's a good deal understood about how the brain is wired up and which site to go after for deep brain stimulation. But basic questions about if you put a wire in the brain and you send a signal through it, is that turning the brain on? Is it turning it off? Is it turning some part on and other parts off? These are still questions that we're wondering about more than 20 years later after tens of thousands of people have had this treatment. So there are still mysteries in deep brain stimulation.
So let's talk a little bit about diagnosis. You and others have learned that Parkinson's is in fact a whole body syndrome. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is one of the real insights in the last few years in Parkinson's, is that this is a whole body disease. It's not just limited to loss of dopamine neurons in the brain. There's now clear evidence of things like the nervous system of the gut being involved, which leads to constipation. In fact, constipation is one of the earliest and most reliable predictors of future Parkinson's disease. A large study looked at men in Honolulu, and 30 years later, if they had constipation, they had an almost tenfold increase in the risk of Parkinson's disease. Other systemic symptoms, there's loss of nerve fibers that go to the heart, low blood pressure, quite common in Parkinson's. So it really is a whole body condition and syndrome. So I don't think of it as just a brain disease anymore. When we have a patient that presents for evaluation of suspected Parkinson's disease, one of the first things my fellows start asking about is, well, have you lost your sense of smell? Do you have constipation? Do you act out your dreams at night? And so that really becomes a factor in your clinical thinking. They have REM sleep disorder and they can't smell things and they have constipation and they have low blood pressure. Well, you know, in the context of that, I'm going to assign a lot more significance to this tremor than I would otherwise.
And that's a change, right?
Yeah, that is a big change in clinical practice. I mean, when I started in this field, we never thought about those kinds of things. But now they're a routine part of thinking about the diagnosis of Parkinson's.
I want to talk about what we're beginning to understand on the genetic frontier and these new biomarkers.
So the genetic discoveries, I think, have been really important. And probably one of the most powerful discoveries is this protein alpha-synuclein. And so alpha-synuclein was discovered in a small group of patients, a family that's located in southern Italy and Greece, because it was known that they had a very high rate of Parkinson's. It's an early onset kind of Parkinson's. They get it in their 30s, and they have a lot of cognitive problems as well. So really kind of a nasty, aggressive form of Parkinson's. So they found that the gene responsible in this family was a mutation in a protein called alpha-synuclein. And even if you don't have a mutation, this protein builds up in many people with Parkinson's disease. And the Lewy body, which had been described more than 100 years ago as a structure in the brain found in people affected by Parkinson's, is made largely of alpha-synuclein. So what this means is that synuclein can misfold and serve as a seed and propagate. So once you plant a bad seed, you get a spreading of a bad problem. And almost 90% of patients with Parkinson's will have this misfolded synuclein.
So this sounds like it could be a pretty big advancement in Parkinson's.
These biomarkers are giving us a window into biology in the brain. So more than 90% of people will have this abnormal synuclein that you can detect in the spinal fluid. Now, it's true that, you know, maybe 10% don't, and they may have something different. There may be a different disease biology going on there. But this is certainly a unifying feature of many patients. And then we'll start thinking about, well, okay, if misfolded synuclein is part of the problem, what can we do to reduce, remove, attenuate that abnormal synuclein? There are a lot of other ideas in the pipeline, but it's certainly a direction the field is going to explore as a way to try and modify Parkinson's disease.
So even though this biomarker is not yet ready for prime time, it could be a game changer in terms of our study of the biology of this disease.
To me, that is really the excitement around this biomarker, is that if this is a predictive biomarker and can tell you something about who's likely to get Parkinson's, then can you intervene before they develop symptoms of Parkinson's? And can we use this in sort of a screening mode to find people who might be at high risk, figure out why they're at high risk, and then possibly intervene to prevent the disease?
So what kinds of new treatments are we working on now to actually change the course of Parkinson's?
Right. So that is the big goal in the field, is disease modifying treatments. I mean, it's great that we have treatments for symptoms, but ultimately every patient I talk to is thinking about their future. That's what they fear the most. Most of them tell me that if I could just stop the disease in its tracks, they'd be okay with what they have today. They can live with this, but they can't live with the idea that it's going to get worse and nothing can be done to stop it. That's what really terrifies them. So focusing on this idea of slowing or halting the progression of Parkinson's is really where the field needs to go. And how can you do that? Well, you know, some of this work in fundamental causes, genetics has taken us, I think, in useful directions. Alpha-synuclein, there are some other genes that are linked to it that are ideas about how to do that. We've worked a lot on inflammation in the brain. And at autopsy, you can see that there's inflammation there. It's a really dramatic kind of inflammation. And up until maybe 7 or 8 years ago, most people would have said, well, it's a degenerative disease. There are neurons dying and it's all reactive and it's not important. And what's happened in the last few years is we've turned that on its head and said, well, actually, no, maybe the inflammation is the problem. Maybe the inflammation is what's driving the progress of the disease from 1 year to the next.
And what's the evidence for that?
Well, actually, there are a couple of good anecdotal stories. One of the strongest is looking at people who are being treated for inflammatory bowel disease. If you look at patients with inflammatory bowel disease, large populations of them, first of all, they're more likely to have Parkinson's than the general population. So having inflammatory bowel disease increases your risk. But if you've been treated with TNF inhibitors, there's a tremendous reduction in the risk of Parkinson's. More than 90% reduction in the risk if you're on one of these TNF inhibitors for inflammatory bowel disease.
And what does that tell us?
Well, it suggests that inflammation in Parkinson's is actually one of the drivers of the disease, and that if you hit the right anti-inflammatory at the right time, you may be able to prevent or slow the disease. Now, are TNF-alpha inhibitors the answer? No, they're not. They have other problems. They increase the risk of serious infections. I certainly would not want to see everyone run out and put themselves on TNF inhibitors to try and prevent Parkinson's. We need something more focused. We need something more selective than that. But that's just a proof of principle that an anti-inflammatory treatment could greatly reduce the risk of disease.
And what about GLP-1s? We've seen some evidence that they may actually modify Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, so the GLP-1 receptor is one of the hot topics of medicine of the day. Ozempic and some of these other drugs that have become very popular in the weight loss world. And they have a number of different actions, but one of them is that they do seem to reduce inflammation in the brain. And so there has been several studies over the last 4 or 5 years looking at the question of whether GLP-1 agonists could alter the rate of progression of Parkinson's disease.
And what about the importance of environmental factors and what we know or what we don't know?
Well, this is the environment is the other half of the story, right? And probably the biggest recent story came out of Camp Lejeune, where the water there was contaminated with a chemical called trichloroethylene, or TCE. And quite a few people over the decades were exposed to high levels of TCE by living at Camp Lejeune. And so a very nice study was done comparing people who'd served there versus another Marine Corps camp, Camp Pendleton, where the water didn't have that problem. And they found a 70% increase in the rate of Parkinson's disease in Camp Lejeune. This has been seen elsewhere too. TCE, unfortunately, is a very common chemical. It was used in dry cleaning, and a number of sites are contaminated from old dry cleaning plants. It was used in aerospace and in manufacturing. I had a patient who worked in a coal mine in his younger days, and I said, did you ever work with any chemicals? And he said, yeah, we had this bucket of TCE, and I would take a rag and wipe down the equipment at the end of the day. And I said, did you wear any gloves or anything? Oh, no, it was great for getting the grease off my hands, too. And TCE contamination is a big problem. It's not the only contaminant that probably contributes to Parkinson's. There's certainly others. So these are chemical exposures we're talking about, but there are also things like mechanical exposures. People with head injury are at increased risk of Parkinson's. You know, history of concussion is a risk factor for Parkinson's. So the environment isn't just the chemicals you're around, it's the physical and experiences that you've had as well.
So do we know why the cells are dying and why this gets worse?
The bottom line answer is no, we don't really know what's killing the neurons. There's a number of different processes that seem to be important. Mitochondrial function seems to be one. Excitotoxicity has been looked at. Buildup of proteins like alpha-synuclein. And I really think the immune system is a contributor. I don't think it's the cause of Parkinson's. I think it's really the accelerant. Once the process starts, what makes it get worse every year? And that's really where I think the immune system's important.
How hopeful are you that you are going to be able to offer your patients something else beyond what you're offering them now?
The thing I always try to convey to patients is, first of all, we've come a long way already. You know, most of the time when people come to see us in the clinic, we can find a treatment or an intervention which will help them. But the problem is the disease does progress over time, and we really don't have a meaningful way to stop that. And so, you know, this focus, I think, has really shifted from managing symptoms, because we've gotten pretty good at that, to how do we slow the disease? This is the top priority now, is how do you modify the disease over time? How do you prevent it from getting worse year by year?
And you feel like you're pretty optimistic about that.
The most hopeful thing to me is the focus that we have now on really studying treatment in humans. We're actually taking on trials of therapies that we were doing in rodents 5 years ago. Now those are being done in people. And that's the critical ingredient. You've got to do clinical trials to move this forward. And I think this is huge progress. Now, in the meantime, what do I tell people they should do? If there's any treatment which is known to be beneficial in Parkinson's right now, it's exercise. There is no doubt in my mind that people who get serious about exercise, who have a regular exercise program, do better over the years than people who don't. What's the mechanism of that? Is it simply making you stronger and more able to deal with the burden of Parkinson's? Or is it actually changing what's going on in the brain and the rest of the body? I don't think we completely know, but in any case, it doesn't matter. People do better if they exercise and build strength and build their endurance, and they will have a better outcome.
Dr. Standard, thank you so very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and I really enjoyed getting an opportunity to talk about this topic.
That's Dr. David Standard. He's chair of neurology at the University of Alabama Medical School. We had help from deputy editor Dr. Alan Roper and our managing editor, Deborah Molina. Our engineer is Mike Toda. Next time, a life-saving therapy that prevents death from difficult-to-treat cancers may actually be causing them.
The prospect that a patient can receive a one-time dose of a drug that goes into their body, eradicates disease, and then reawakens whenever the cancer cells tries to divide again, I think that hope, that promise is something too bright to be left on the table.
That's next time on Intention to Treat from the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Rachel Gottbach.